Ryan, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Andy Mock. I'm here with my law partner, Melissa Tannery. Together we represent Wetlands America Trust, which I'll refer to as WATT. They're the owner of a conservation easement on land located in Loudoun County, and they believe the landowner's activities violate the easement. This is a very important case for conservation easements in Virginia, because the trial court held that certain terms of the easement were ambiguous. It then applied the standard for restrictive covenants and construed those ambiguities in favor of the free use of property. And we, along with the amicus that filed briefs, believe that was in error as a matter of law. To get to that, the court had to find ambiguity. So the initial position of Watt was that the easement is not ambiguous, that he erred when he held it ambiguous. But the big issue, I think, really is the most interest is that if he found ambiguities, how do you construe them? And I think there are two arguments on that. A restrictive covenant is decidedly and fundamentally different than a conservation easement, and the common law just doesn't apply to it. And second is, if it did apply to it, the common law has been is repugnant to the Constitution, was abrogated by the common law, or times have changed such that that's not the case anymore.
Well, the common law has to be abrogated not by common law, but by statutory law according to the statute. The common law, English common law, cannot be abrogated by us. Only repugnancy to the Constitution and the General Assembly can abrogate English common law, which carries over through the reception statute. So,
or that the common law is a dynamic instrument, and that the times have changed to the extent that the common law.
Well, it didn't. The statute doesn't say common law. Justice Kelsey et al. Says the common law of England, and we've held that the reception statute imports the corpus of English common law. We don't have the authority to change common law unless we find it's repugnant to the Constitution or to a statute. Of course, we must change it then.
Well, what I read was the Surratt case, 212 Virginia, which says the nature of common law requires that each time a rule of law is applied, it to be carefully scrutinized to make sure that the conditions and needs of the time have not so changed as to make further application of it the instrument of injustice.
Well, application changes as different conditions arise, but the principle doesn't change.
Well, I would agree with that. So the principle that a restrictive covenant is to be construed for free use of property may stand, but it shouldn't be applied to a conservation easement.
Well, that's right, but that's a different point.
Okay, so that the common law is repugnant to the Constitution has been abrogated by the General Assembly, and an application shouldn't apply to a conservation easement because times have changed.
Or there never was a conservation easement, negative easement in gross of this type, so no common law construction principles attached to it in the first instance.
Well, that was my first argument. This conservation easement is so fundamentally different. It's not like your typical restrictive easement. And the Attorney General, in its August 31, 2012 opinion, said that conservation easements stand in sharp contrast to conventional easements, where conventional easements are private agreements entered into for the benefit of the grantees. Conservation easements serve a public function and are administrated for the easement holder, not for themselves, but on behalf of the public and in furtherance of public policy. A good example of the difference is a restrictive covenant in a subdivision that says you can only build residential homes. If the people in the subdivision get together and decide they need a 7-Eleven and they want to put it in, they can do that by agreement because it's a private contract. Whereas these parties in a conservation easement, if they decided they want to put a facility that violates the easement in it, they can't do it. My client would lose its charitable status as a charitable entity, and the easement can be enforced by the Attorney General, by the localities, by the Virginia Outdoors Foundation. So the enforcement mechanism is different. Plus, that private subdivision doesn't create rights in the public. It's just a private agreement to handle the idiosyncratic issues in that subdivision, whereas a conservation easement is creates public benefits and rights.
May I interrupt you once again? Putting aside the common law issue, which is sort of academic at one stage, if you went through this trial judge's very thorough opinion, topic by topic, and you lay out the contextual facts as well as the drafting issues with the text of the easement, why wouldn't the right answer be the same just looking at it without any bias in favor of broad or narrow or up or down or whatever construction? Just read the text and apply it to the factual contest. In many occasions we have battles of experts on these various things. So I'm wondering if the tail's wagging the dog here. We make a lot in the briefs of the threshold question, but I seriously question if that's important enough to worry with if the result's going to be the same.
Well, I don't believe it's the same because the court felt that the certain provisions were either ambiguous and construed them for the free use of land, or I think they're unambiguous, or he misconstrued them. And a good example to me is if you look at the primary purpose of this easement, which is section 1.1, it is the purpose. And it states that the property is to be retained in perpetuity in its natural, scenic, and open condition as evidenced by the baseline documentation report. That's a report that's done as the time the easement is created. It takes a snapshot of the photo of the property. So if you come back to that property 100 years from now, it should look almost exactly like it looked in 2001, per as evidenced by the baseline documentation report. That is and the same page says it's the objective informational baseline for monitoring compliance. And if there's a breach, we as the holder can require the property to be put back in the condition it was in 2001, which is exactly what the federal tax law holds, and I cited the court to 26 CFR 1.170.
Excuse me a second. I don't want to monopolize your argument, but the baseline report's a baseline. The rest of the easement allows certain development and certain activities. So it's not as simple as taking a Polaroid of it 50 years ago and saying it's got to look like that today.
I don't agree, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. It says the property will be retained in perpetuity. That's not ambiguous. In the condition, predominantly, now there you get some wiggle room, predominantly, so you can move things around, in its natural, scenic, and open condition as evidenced by the report. So if you're going to retain something...
As well as permitted buildings, so a foreign structure...
As long as it, but if you look at the baseline, then you need to go to the baseline documentation report. What did the property look like in 2001? It had a few buildings on it. So moving the buildings around or rehabbing an old building wouldn't change the way it looked in 2001.
So they can't create a new farm building is indisputably a farm building? That didn't exist at the time of the Polaroid?
If you met the other restrictions and you had a farm building that still maintained the property predominantly in the condition, so if you rehab a farm or you put a small farm building here, the problem is what she is doing far exceeds anything that could fit under predominantly. She's putting a three-story, 14,000 square foot building, and it's not just the building, it's the several acre parking lot, the road, and then how she's using it. Because Section 1.1 doesn't just talk about retaining in its perpetuity. It says any use, and it's to prevent any use. That doesn't say permit or not. That will impair significantly or interfere with the conservation values of the property, its habitat, resources, or associated ecosystem. And it directs you to the baseline documentation report to determine what the conservation values are. So again, you go back to the baseline documentation report, and it says the current management of the easement property is directed at responsible, low-impact agriculture and promotion of wildlife habitat. So if you're going to have agriculture, it's permitted. True, it has to be low-impact. There are only 40 acres.
Mr. Mouth, may I ask you a question with regard to that? It's my understanding that the Appalachian activities constitute 5% of the entire property. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you look at the physical footprint.
Physically, it's a physically 5%.
Right.
How do you determine then what is predominantly, or as the 1.1 talks about, they do allow certain activity, but you're talking about something that's limited to a very specific part of 100%, not 5%. Of the property.
Well, I don't believe there's a footprint requirement because I gave the example in the trial court of you could put a small couple of nuclear waste and it would only take up a very small footprint, but it would have a large impact. So you're not looking at, it doesn't say an amount of square footage. It's, the question is, how is it predominantly in the same condition? And does it substantially impair those? That's sort of the same context, concept as materiality.
Well, shouldn't we defer to the trial court? I mean, the trial court lived with this case for a period of time. We're hearing it for 15 minutes apiece.
But the court didn't make the decisions in some cases. It ruled, for instance, on the baseline documentation report. It said you don't have to retain the property in the condition that it's in for permitted uses, which is just an incorrect statement of the. So he says you don't have to retain it, but I say Section 1.1 says you do. And just because it's a permitted activities have limits. So if you look at grading, for instance, in that section on grading, it says the landowner may grade, they have to get written permission from the holder, that can't be unreasonably denied for water resources. And at the end, it says any grading has to support the conservation values. Same when you go to buildings. All buildings have to be located so they don't violate.
If this building weren't a farm building, as you say, if it were a wine and cheese building, which is not a farm building in your interpretation, you would say still that it's beyond the baseline Polaroid, so therefore, even though it's technically permissible, it's not allowed? In other words, you're saying there's a fallback, ultimately, no matter how many permitted uses you get, somewhere along the line, the baseline theory is going to say, you've gone too far, you've changed the character. I sort of get that, and language sort of suggests that.
That's right.
But that makes irrelevant whether or not something's permitted or not permitted. Here, the debate we're having is whether or not this building is permitted or not permitted. You say it's not, they say it is. But why does the fallback even become relevant? It's just one building.
Well, because there's a specific limitation on buildings. It says it has to be a farm building. So you first have to get over the threshold that it's a farm building. If it's a farm building, and it's not built on highly erodible soils, and it doesn't, and its construction didn't materially alter the topography, and if they got written permission for the grading, you satisfy all those, then you step back and you go, does this facility retain the land in its condition set forth in the BDR, and does it significantly impair the conservation values and habitat? And so it's a multi-layer, and each restriction has a return back. And I think one important paragraph, I believe, is 3.19, and that's the one that says the parties agree that if there's a change of circumstance that they can't foresee, they return to this purpose. They understood they couldn't. This is in perpetuity, which means obviously forever. They couldn't understand all the circumstances. So in 3.19, they said, "Hey, this document can't look at every circumstance. When in doubt, look at the purpose, and that is to retain this property. That's the whole purpose of a conservation easement. You are giving the landowner a tax credit because they are preserving their property in the way it is, based on the appraisal at the time the easement's put in place." That's the concept of it. So I think the court erred, and that's why we have specific errors on whether it's a farm building or whether it's on highly erodible soil or whether the bridge is a structure, but we also have the bigger picture items. Does it violate the purpose of the easement?
But Mr. Malk, in 1.1 that you read so often, it also says... for conservation purposes as well as permitted agricultural pursuits. Doesn't that phrase require some kind of balancing here that would have to that any court in deciding whether or not something violated would have to undergo in terms of how much disruption there is? Because it does allow agricultural purposes, including commercial agricultural purposes. The easement does.
That's what was occurring on the property in 2001. It was being that if you look at the baseline documentation report.
I understand that.
So you're preserving it, you're retaining it in perpetuity, and the reason you're doing it is because you can have conservation purposes and agriculture. That's a permitted use. I agree with that. but it has to be consistent with the way it looked in 2001 because you are retaining it in perpetuity as evidenced by the baseline report. So they're not inconsistent and they don't cancel each other out. They just explain sort of why you're protecting it. And so commercial agriculture, the way it was done in 2001, was 40 acres of row crops. They could have that. They could sell it on the market. They could have a barn, maybe a silo. But that doesn't mean you can just have all sorts of commercial agriculture and lose the character of the property the way it was in 2001. And this facility is so significant. When you look at the pictures, if you look at the Facebook pages, if you look at the newsletters, if you look, just take a picture and look at the parking lot, 144 cars, buses, vans, motorcycles, 50,000 people a year. This is not a close call. This is way beyond predominant. This is way beyond low-impact agriculture.
Are there any further questions? Thank you. Your time has expired.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew Bertram. I'm here along with my law partner, Michael Kalish, and Ms. Jenny McLeod, who's the owner of the Appalachian White Cloud 9 Ventures. Justice Lacey, you picked up on it.
Is she a lawyer?
No, sir.
Ma'am, I'm sorry to have to do this to you, but you're going to have to sit in the crowd.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize
that. That's right.
You'll
have to be back in the crowd. The council table is for counsel.
I'm sorry
as well. Go ahead.
Justice Lacey, you picked up on it exactly with regard to what the purpose of this this easement is, and it includes permitted agricultural pursuits. Section 3 of the easement jumps right in and also says, it's some important language, it goes on to say that the grantor states and agrees that the uses and practices as permitted herein, though not intended as exhaustive recital of the permitted rights, are hereby deemed consistent with the purpose of this easement. So in other words, we don't even get to the predominant state of this at the state of the baseline document report because these activities are deemed consistent with the terms of the easement.
Well, excuse me, counsel, are you saying then that the scope of whatever would be involved with horticulture or you were going to build huge mechanized barns for mechanized machinery because that's the way you were going to plant wheat, for example, which you say you're going to plant, and it took up the whole property, that because that was a recognized activity, that you never get to the idea of whether or not the purpose clause has been violated?
No, because, Your Honor, because it says conservation purposes as well as permitted agricultural pursuits, and there's a balance at some point.
So there, you're saying there's got to be a balance.
There's some balance, but in
so
this
who
case...
Who gets to decide the balance?
The trial court gets to decide the balance, and trial court did decide that balance in this particular case. In fact, the trial court found that it was a de minimis impact. We had expert witnesses testify about the impact on the habitat, and the court didn't find that there was any impact on any significant impact on the habitat. And getting to the appellant's argument with regard to whether or not these conservation easements are different creatures and should be interpreted differently, I disagree with counsel's argument that you have to get to the ambiguity context in order to apply the concept of restrictions against the free use of property or nearly construed. The case of Jernigan, which is cited by the appellant as authority that this court should not go into ambiguity, specifically uses that principle and never even got into ambiguities. So why is that true? I mean, it makes sense because we...
But do you even need strict construction in a case like this?
I'm sorry.
Do you even need strict construction in a case like this?
No, I don't think so. But in this case, that's the standard in which the court is going to look at these restrictions and decide if there's any ambiguity or if there's any doubt. And there's a difference between ambiguity and doubt. If there's any doubt, that it gets narrowly construed in favor of the free use of land. Now, one of the arguments that the council makes in their briefs is that somehow the Virginia Conservation Easement Act has trumped the common law in this case. There's no indication that is the case. The case of this court held in U.S. versus Blackmun analyzed this in fairly great detail. And in Blackmun, what was interesting is that the same parties that were the arguing for the fact that the common law had not changed as a result of the Conservation Easement Act are now on the other side of this, saying that the Conservation Easement Act did change the common law. But this court never held that. The Virginia, you can look through the Conservation Easement Act, and it does not in any way, shape, or form alter the common law such that restrictions against the free use of property should be narrowly...
Well, counsel, can I ask you this? That these were really, in the Blackmun case, called an easement in gross.
Yes,
right? Okay, a restrictive easement in gross. And the reason, and they were disfavored because they were restrictions on land, and therefore they did not allow, originally didn't, were not allowed to be inherited or transferred. And then the legislature changed that early on, and then we had the 60 and 62 and 68 and all the other statutes. In doing that, didn't the legislature change the nature in the sense that they were no longer disfavored? In other words, they became a favorable, they were a type of transfer of property rights that the Constitution of Virginia in the 70s and now the acts that were enacted changed that perception from disfavor to favor.
No, it I would say that it narrowly did that in terms of the transferability of those, but not in the interpretation of those.
Well, I'm just asking you, as a matter of policy, in fact, Blackmun said it became very favorable. It was to get a conservation easement was something good, something as a matter of public policy that the Commonwealth wanted them to do. So isn't that type of a transfer then, in this context, a change in the common law approach to negative easements and gross?
It shouldn't change the way that these that restrictions against the free use of property interpreted. I mean,
but the only reason that they were interpreted that way was because they were disfavored.
No, that's not exactly right. Because the common law favors, as in Blackmun. Blackmun says that you have this balancing of the alienability of property. I'll read the language from Blackmun that says that the common law preference for unrestricted rights of ownership of real property and the public policy that this Commonwealth has expressed as it relates to the motion of the environment. Those two things were in tension in Blackmun and clearly identified, but it didn't separate out and say that the common law preference for unrestricted rights of ownership and real property has been abrogated. What it did was it focused on 55-6 and the transferability of easements and groves.
So they are still disfavored for purposes of interpretation, although not for purposes of execution.
Well, I think it's a question of who gets the burden of clarity gets allocated to. The common law principle of he who wants to enforce a restriction needs to has the burden of proving a clear restriction and a clear violation of that restriction. And so the idea is that these easements are drafted by these wetland or these conservation organizations. My client is a subsequent owner of the property.
Well, and doesn't that mean your client has to take it with the same thing as the grantor? I mean, he in effect is the grantor of this particular document, which normally is interpreted against. If there's ambiguity, you interpret it against the grantor.
No, that's for affirmative rights. I would agree with you for affirmative rights, but not for restricted, not for the veto rights. And Blackmun goes through a very good distinction of the affirmative rights versus the veto rights. And in fact, this easement actually separates those two out. Section 2 of the easement talks about the affirmative rights, and Section 3 of the easement says restrictions and covenants. So it's consistent with. Our brief went into great detail on this distinction between the affirmative rights and these veto rights. And these veto rights ought to be narrowly construed, especially when you're talking about a document that needs to have some clarity. Obviously, we're standing here, we're arguing different points of this. This document is not a clear document.
It seems as though, too, the opening provision of the Virginia Conservation Easement Act says this: Except as otherwise provided in this chapter, a conservation easement may be created, conveyed, recorded, assigned, released, modified, terminated, or otherwise altered or affected in the same manner as other easements.
Yes, Your Honor. It also says that in Section 10.14.
So if this is, in fact, a negative easement in gross, and negative easement in gross easements, when there is an ambiguity, are construed against the restriction, then the statute appears to be commanding us to do that, as opposed to the opposite.
That would be my position, yes, sir. I think it's important to recognize that if they really wanted what they are saying that they want to be able to control what the landowner is doing, they could have easily said that, and that language is used in the Scott v. Walker case, and it kind of resonates here. They could easily say, you can do nothing on the property above the baseline document report. That was the argument that council made here. You can't really do anything above the baseline document report, and if you do something, we can restore it back to the baseline document report. That's not what this document says. But had it said that, I think that people who subsequently buy property that are subject to conservation easements would recognize that, and then they would be very wary of these. But when you read through this easement and you see all the express permitted rights, industrial and commercial agriculture, the ability to put buildings on here, the ability to regrade to put buildings, the ability to put roads to permitted buildings, this easement does not contemplate or look anywhere in the fashion that they say that it does. And it's their burden to provide and talk about and present clear restrictions. And this trial court went through those restrictions and spent 5 days in great detail and went through each one of them and determined that they did not violate any of the terms of the easement. Unless the court has any
questions. What about the section where they, regarding the parking lot, which is a use, not a, it's a kind of a swept in use with the building that was going to be built. I guess at that point it was built. And the trial court saw that it was kind of necessary for that, but didn't even talk about whether or not the grading should have been done.
Well, the grading...
The grading should have been considered.
The grading was for the permitted for the building, and the trial court did talk about the ability to grade for permitted buildings, and the parking lot is for the is an ancillary use that is related to the permitted building. In fact, the irony of this is that the whole parking lot is designed to prevent to make this more agricultural, more environmentally friendly, because it is designed to prevent the dirt that is on the property from being taken out when people come and actually go to the permitted building. So the grading was permitted, and the parking lot is just simply a gravel spot over top of it. It's a small area. I mean, I know that they say that it's a large area, but it's the trial court found that it was a de minimis impact.
Let me follow up on the grading, counsel. Looking at the highly erodible areas, it seems to me that that's a sort of circuitous argument that you're making, that we can grade it, make it non-erodible, and then we can construct on it. Is that your position?
That is my position, and it makes sense to me because the whole point is not to build on highly erodible soils.
Right.
There's no environmental impact or preservation of highly erodible soils. The idea is you don't want to be building on steep grades such that erosion occurs as
okay.
a result of...
Well, my question is that 3.3C says that no building or structure, or reads that no building or structure of any nature shall be constructed or maintained on a highly erodible area. But then you argue, well, it's no longer erodible because I have now graded it and it is no longer erodible. But if you can't construct on it in the first place, if it is highly erodible, then aren't you sort of defeating the purpose of the language when you grade it and then say, well, okay, now I can construct?
Not at all, Your Honor, because the idea is that the there's permitted activities which say that you can grade for permitted buildings. And that makes sense. So therefore, that trumps the other component. And additionally, Your Honor, there is no proof. The trial court did not find factually that these were on highly erroneous foot. Their proof failed. They relied upon ambiguous documents, not actually the right standard. So,
did your expert address the issue of what the meaning of highly erodible area is?
There's a fair amount of discussion in the record as to the highly erodible part. And yes, the issue is that the USDA charts don't even discuss highly erodible soils in this context.
I guess my point is, unless it's a question of law that we all intuitively know as judges and lawyers, at some point it's going to require some interpretation by someone in the industry like your expert.
Yes, Your Honor, and they failed to meet their burden of proof at trial on that, you know, on that issue.
Counsel, may I? I'm sorry, have you finished answering?
Yes.
If, in fact, we don't agree with you on the standard that should be used in some way, shape, or form, do you believe that we would have to send this case back or that we could make a decision, a final judgment here?
It depends on what the court is doing. I think that the court can make a decision on this case without whether or not the ambiguity issue is construed in the favor of free use of land or not. The way that this easement is set up is it's clear that this activity was permitted, irrespective of deciding of the ambiguity.
Well, the reason I asked the question is the appellant asked that we reverse the trial court primarily with regard to the standard that they used, and then decide the case, each one of those issues, each one of the seven or six assignments of error, and implying that he believes we could do that without remanding the case for consideration under a different standard.
I don't think you could if that were the direction the court would go, because we also have a cross appeal related to the estoppel argument, the latches argument, and there are a lot.
Well, if we disagreed with your cross, if we did not agree with your cross.
Well, I still think it's going to be a factual determination that there needs to be, that the trial court, who has a much better review of all of the different evidence and the facts, would have to go, look back at it. But also note that this issue associated with the different standard was never raised until after the trial court had actually issued its opinion. I mean, that's one of the part of the problems of this case. If this had really been their position, they should have been saying so throughout trial. We raised Scott v. Walker restrictions on the free use of properties throughout the course of that case.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
3.6 allows alteration of topography as it relates to construction of permitted buildings. The parking lot is there for the use of the permitted building. So how do you justify the parking lot under 3.6?
The grading, Your Honor, it was part of the grading for the permitted building. And that was an ancillary effect associated with the building. You grade it to allow for the building, and then
grade it enough to allow for the parking lot?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that overextending the permitted building, the construction of the permitted building?
Your Honor, and also the easement allows for the creation of roads. The parking lot is where the road ends up. That's where the cars are going. It makes no sense to have this building with no parking.
What if it violates the terms of the agreement?
We don't think that it does.
Thank you.
Mr. Mock, given the nature of that later inquiry, I think it would only be fair to offer you a minute if you'd like to have the podium.
Counsel, I have a question.
All right.
In Section 3.1, it's clear that industrial and commercial activities are allowed. So, there are a lot of details in this case, obviously, but from 30,000 feet, I'm having trouble understanding your 30,000-foot view of this case, which is what's going on this property is way beyond, I think, were the words maybe that you used, anything that was contemplated by the easement when it's clear from 3.1 that industrial and commercial activities are allowed with the exceptions of those things that are listed.
What I said earlier was you first have to look at the specific restrictions. So it has to be a farm building, which we disagree with because there's no farming going on in it. It's manufacturing.
Well, but what does 3.1 mean?
Well, again, you can't... Let's see. I still go back to 1.1, which says you can have a permitted use, which that would be, but it still cannot, it has to retain the property in the condition that it was in, and it cannot substantially impair or interfere with the conservation values which are set forth in the baseline documentation report. So that right is the same as any right under the easement. It is strictly limited.
So it takes you back to substantially impaired. That's
and it has to retain the property. So again, you could have commercial agriculture. That's what was on the property in 2001. They had low impact agriculture. They harvested the crops and they sold them. But you can't have, I think it's a stretch to say that that sort of agriculture going to importing, which is what they're doing. They're importing milk, grapes, and wheat, and flour with some remote tangential relationship to this property. And then they're manufacturing it. That, in a facility that is going to bring in thousands of people, cars, buses, all the activities, that is not retaining the property in the condition it is in. And even though it says, as Justice Lacey said, there are agricultural pursuits in that language, that's nowhere related or near what was going on in 2001. And you have to go back to the level of activity in the baseline documentation report. That's the entire purpose of a conservation easement. If you look, I cited to the federal tax law, it says if a landowner is given the rights that may impair the conservation interest, there must be a baseline documentation report and there must be a right on behalf of the holder to return the property to the condition it was in. And that's also in section 4.14 of the easement. We're going back to 2001.
All right, thank you. I think you've answered her question. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. This session of the Supreme Court of Virginia is now adjourned.
All right.